This is the Andy Pollin Hour. On Washington's new home for sports, ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock, and I know he'll have a lot to say about this Washington Post story about Dan Snyder and what he did to impede in the investigation of the team's culture. We'll get to that in a second. I want to set that up, though, with just a little bit of perspective on the National Football League. I saw this story a few minutes ago. This is a report from Front Office Sports that Amazon wants to steal the Manning Cast, ESPN's alternate broadcast of Monday Night Football, which I love, which is terrific. They're doing 10 games this year, and they have a couple left, the Browns and Steelers, January 3rd, and then the wildcard playoff game on January 17th. And I find when Washington's not playing that I'll watch that because I think they're great. But according to this report, Amazon is willing to pay big, big money once their three-year deal is up with ESPN. And it's Omaha Productions, which is owned by the brothers. And they would have a ton of money for the show as well as other programming for them. It's not a bad idea for the Mannings to get in bed with Amazon because, well, they have billions of dollars, lots and lots of money. And I point this out first just to show you what a behemoth the NFL is. It is a money gusher. The money is just flowing out of this league. And with money comes power, and power corrupts. And we'll get to that in a second. The Amazon is looking to buy 49% of the league's properties, such as the NFL Network. And they're also looking to put together a dream team, announced team for next year when all the Thursday night games are going to be on Amazon Prime. They want to do Al Michaels and Troy Aikman together. I point this out because of what we're going to talk about here. And the front page story in the Washington Post, it's banner headline, Snyder worked behind the scenes to stymie probe. And if you haven't read the story, you know the gist of it by now. It's a very lengthy story, and it includes a lot of things that have already been reported, but they're tied together with these latest reports of what happened with the Beth Wilkinson investigation. And I'll just read you the first paragraph here. In July 2020, just a few days after prominent D.C. attorney Beth Wilkinson began investigating allegations of widespread sexual harassment in the Washington football team workplace, she learned of a decade-old allegation of sexual misconduct against team owner Daniel Snyder. Snyder had for years privately denied the woman's claims, but the existence of an allegation against him, which had been kept secret by a confidential $1.6 million settlement, had the potential to rock a franchise already reeling from scandal. And according to this report, Snyder's attorneys attempted to get this woman, who had already received this $1.6 million settlement, not to cooperate with Beth Wilkinson, and that they were willing to offer more money on top of the $1.6 million that she had already received in 2009 if she agreed not to speak to anyone about the allegations. Now, you remember, Dan Snyder, after the Washington Post had its initial report last summer, not this past summer, but the summer before of 2020, that he hired Beth Wilkinson to conduct a quote-unquote independent investigation. And then there was a second Washington Post report, which revealed more, and the league said, okay, we'll take it from here. Now, it's unclear as to whether Beth Wilkinson was working for the league at that point or still working for Dan Snyder in this quote-unquote independent investigation. But whenever it was happening, there was action, according to the Post, by Snyder's attorneys to get this woman not to talk to Beth Wilkinson and her investigator. Now, ultimately, they did talk to the woman, and apparently, and this is what has everybody, I think, thinking this morning, well, geez, if this is out there and there was this horrible thing between Dan Snyder and this woman, why can't they get him out of there? Why can't this be the final straw that gets Dan Snyder booted out as owner? The wording of this in the Post, and I heard an attorney on another station today explain this, and I think it makes a lot of sense. It's a decade-old allegation of sexual misconduct, which means that the league may have looked at this whatever went on between Dan Snyder and this woman, and allegedly it happened during a flight where they were coming home from a Dick Clark Productions event in 2009, or going to, anyway, was on the team plane. They may have looked into this and said it doesn't rise to the level of what would be considered criminal misconduct or sexual misconduct is how it's worded, but does not rise to the level of getting Dan Snyder booted out the door. So there's that in this. Now, they went to Snyder and his attorneys to get a comment on this. There was no comment on any of this about this report that Snyder and his attorneys attempted to coerce the woman not to speak to Beth Wilkinson and that they would offer more money to do that. In a statement released after the story was published online, and this dropped by the Washington Post about 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, A. Scott Bolden of the law firm Reed Smith, which represents Snyder and the team, said, "Untrue. It did not happen. Absolutely no effort was made by me or any Reed Smith lawyers to dissuade anyone from speaking with Beth Wilkinson or otherwise cooperating with her investigation, nor was any money offered to anyone not to cooperate. Anyone suggesting something to the contrary is lying." Okay, if that's the case, if this whole Washington Post report that this enormous story is based on is untrue, why doesn't Dan Snyder hold a news conference today with Jason Wright, the team president, and one or more of the female executives connected with the team, perhaps even Julie Donaldson, who is the director of broadcasting, and say, "This is a hit job. This is totally untrue." You think that's going to happen? No, it's not going to happen. That's not how they conduct business. But if, in fact, that lawyer's statement is correct, that all of this is untrue, that it's made up, that somebody told them something that's completely untrue about this woman being offered more money not to talk to Beth Wilkinson, then come out and say it. Let everybody know that the Washington Post had a hit piece. Is it going to happen? No, it's not. On top of all this, and this is just one aspect of the investigation, private investigators working on Snyder's behalf showed up uninvited at homes of several former employees or contacted their friends and relatives, according to those former employees or their attorneys, acts many of them viewed as intimidation aimed at discouraging former employees from participating in the NFL's investigation. So it's more than just this woman who made this $1.6 million settlement with Dan Snyder. It is others who were being questioned in this, former team employees. Remember, there were 40 of them who came forward and said that there was a culture of harassment in the organization. Wilkinson ultimately did interview Snyder's accuser, according to court records, but the revelation that Snyder was accused of trying to block a witness from participating in the NFL's investigation raises new concerns about Commissioner Roger Goodell's decision to keep confidential any report or investigative findings produced by Wilkinson, a departure from how the league has handled investigations in recent years. Previous NFL probes into the Ray Rice domestic violence case and the Deflategate controversy resulted in detailed public reports. A league-sponsored investigation of Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson, which substantiated allegations that he had harassed women on the team staff and used a racial slur, resulted in the release of the executive's findings. Okay, let me point out a couple of things about what this paragraph says. And it's 100% correct. But the difference in what's happened here with Snyder and what happened in those cases is they had smoking guns. What the NFL has done with this case is they have thrown the smoking gun into the East River, because Beth Wilkinson's report was done orally. There is no paper trail on this. There is nothing that they can find. The Ray Rice incident, in case you don't remember, initially, there was a video that came out of Rice dragging his then fiance off the elevator. And it could have been that she was drunk and passed out or taken some drugs, and nobody knew what happened. And the league looked at that and decided not to do anything about it. TMZ later, but they did investigate, said they couldn't come up with anything. TMZ later produced another video which showed Ray Rice decking the woman in the elevator and punching her out. Boom, they had that smoking gun. That's it. Ray Rice is gone. So they had that. They had that second thing. Now, Did the league do a good job of investigating? No, because TMZ was able to snap its fingers and find the video. You know, they didn't work very hard to find that second video, which TMZ obviously found quite easily. Deflategate, well, at least they had a football that didn't measure up in pounds. I think that was a make good on what happened with Spygate when the NFL gave the Patriots a slap on the hand for spying on the New York Jets during a game when they had evidence of that. But whatever it was, at least they had some type of smoking gun. And with Jerry Richardson, he was willing to sell the team. As I recall, they did not order him to sell the Carolina Panthers, but he was in his 80s and he was willing to do that. Dan Snyder ain't going down without a fight. And there's something that's very, very revealing late in this long story in the Post about this latest allegation that Snyder coerced others in the investigation not to cooperate with Beth Wilkinson. And I'll read you these couple of paragraphs, which I think is an amazing illustration of a man who is now 55 years old. He was the boy wonder when he bought the team back in 1999. He was 34 years old, and many assumed, wow, he must be wise beyond his years. Look at that. He bought an NFL team at the age of 34. He must be really, really smart, and he must really have great people skills to be able to negotiate around the NFL owners to make this happen. Well, here's what we learn from this story. January 2020, the news conference announcing Ron Rivera's hire, the famous Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, from Dan Snyder, the day after New Year's when he greeted everybody in the press with that one. According to sources, Dan Snyder learned that Bruce Allen had sent a congratulatory text to Rivera. Snyder was insulted, people said, that he didn't receive a similar text from Allen, whom Snyder had fired a few weeks earlier. Well, I kind of understand it from Bruce's perspective that I guess he has a relationship with Ron Rivera, and he may have had a relationship with Dan Snyder, but that relationship had obviously changed when Snyder had fired him a few weeks earlier. So you understand why he didn't send one to Dan as well. Gets better. Later that year, the team, citing the pandemic, attempted to get out of paying Allen all of his money he was owed under the contract. Allen fought back, and Snyder agreed to pay his full salary. But in a message sent to Allen's lawyers over settlement terms, one of Snyder's lawyers included a condition that Allen wouldn't agree to meet, according to a text message received by the Post. In addition, I understand that Mr. Allen has agreed to send a text message to Mr. Snyder stating, "Congrats on the hire," Snyder's attorney wrote in July 2020, 7 months after Snyder hired Rivera. Allen's lawyers resolved the pay dispute, but he never sent the text, according to a person with knowledge of the case. He is that petty and that immature. He was immature as a 34-year-old when he bought the team, and now as a middle-aged man, he's that immature and that petty and that insecure. I want my text message too. He got a text message. How come I didn't get one? And in settling the case, agreeing to pay what he was required to pay, you know, not trying to weasel out of it because of the pandemic, but what he was required to pay under the terms of the contract, he wanted to throw in a clause that he had to get a congratulatory text message from Bruce Allen. For what? So he could show his friends? Show his wife? Show his kids? What is the point of this? The pettiness knows no bounds. And so I look at that vis-a-vis what's going on with the team and the investigation. And if you ask the question, well, why don't the other owners pressure Dan Snyder to sell the team? That's why. Because he'll stop at nothing to sue them. And he's got information on them as well that he will be able to get out if he wants to. And they know that. There's also the Roger Goodell angle to this, which Sally Jenkins writes about very well in the Post today. And one thing about Sally, she was on Crushing Snyder very, very early, and she has crushed Goodell from the jump. And I will say this about the two men, and this is just pop psychology here, but I have seen this in my business. You may have seen it in your business. When someone wants something and has laser focus on getting that, he or she can often get it, stopping at nothing. Roger Goodell, as has been reported in great stories done by Don Van Natta and others, came into the NFL as an intern, telling people that he wanted to become commissioner of the NFL. His first job was to drive around the commissioner, Pete Rozelle at the time, and then Paul Tagliabue. And when someone has laser focus like that and will stop at nothing to get what he wants, he will get that. And Roger Goodell eventually rose to that, being the guy who was willing to do the dirty work. You know, there was a report that they had a multi-year deal with Nike, signed, sealed, and delivered. He renegotiated the deal. He was able to break it open. They liked that. He was able to shake more money out of the parking meters. And they liked that, and they hired him, and they paid him a lot of money. And he did that. Dan Snyder was focused on making money. He spent, I believe, a year at the University of Maryland. And from what I've been told by people who actually knew him at the time, he was focused on making cash. He was selling spring break trips to students. He put out a magazine, which ultimately failed and was bankrolled by Fred Drasner, but he got him to bankroll him in another business, and he made a fortune in the communications business, which I'm not sure what it entailed, but he became very, very rich and got himself in a position to buy the team with the help of Drasner, who was, again, a partner in buying the Washington football team in 1999. And Sally writes this paragraph here. You could pass out from all the cross pollutants, Snyder's noxious combined with the ammonia smell of a cover-up. But the biggest stench of all is the odor of Goodell's false, rotten-tooth assurances, which were merely a front for the owner's collective contempt for both ordinary people and congressional leaders, whom they treat as stupidly cow-placid enough to swallow this nonsense while paying for their public sewage lines. Whew. Wow. But that's it. I mean, this is, as I just started with, this is a money gusher. And when money is gushing like that, people do things that you might not normally do. And so when this all came out, I'm sure that Roger Goodell looked at this and said, this can't see the light of day. This can't be the smoking gun like the second Ray Rice video. This can't even be the smoking gun like the deflated football. This just cannot get out there. And so he has reiterated that he is not going to release the findings. Now, there's uproar from Congress about that. And after this report came out again yesterday, there was another cry for the NFL to release this. But I don't know if they will. People look at this report and say, "Ooh, that's got to be it for Dan Snyder." Not so fast. I think that the way the league has circled the wagons on this, and the way that they're able to protect him with a lot of lawyering up and legalese, I think this unfortunately just passes. I don't. Those who say, "Oh yeah, this is the road to the end of Dan Snyder," I don't see it. I don't see it. I just see just another embarrassing incident in a series of them over his 22 years of owning the football team. And I urge you to read the whole story because it's really good and really well written. It may make you mad, but it may make you, if you're not already there, not a fan of the team anymore. But I don't think that this story is going to rise to the level of getting Dan Snyder booted out of the NFL. I just don't think that's going to happen. It's distasteful. It's disgusting. And he's got a co-conspirator, as Sally points out, in the commissioner. But it's a league that is printing money. And as bad as the attendance has been at FedEx Field, it ain't hurting Snyder because the television money is flowing. Coming up, look into Micah Parsons, a couple of guests on the Dan Patrick Show with interesting insight on the comparison to Lawrence Taylor. We'll get to that and more as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock. I know he'll have some more to say on the big Washington Post report on Dan Snyder and the allegation that he impeded in the investigation of the team by an attorney that he originally hired, and then the investigation was taken over by the league. If you're just jumping in your car, I ranted about that for about 15 minutes or so. My takeaway is that while it looks bad, once again, I don't think it's going to force the sale of the Washington football team by Daniel Snyder. Now, this is not going to be helpful in getting a new stadium built. And the way things are trending right now, unless there's a major, major change, I don't think anything's going to be built. They have an obligation, a good column yesterday or the day before from Barry Zwerluga in the Post about the shrinking attendance and what has happened to the franchise since the glory days of RFK when they played their last game there 25 years ago. He points out, they have an obligation to stay at FedEx Field through 2027. Doesn't mean they can't stay there in 2028 and 2029 and on and on and on. And if they don't get a new stadium built, that is probably what's going to happen, because it doesn't look like Virginia wants it. Maryland has said it doesn't want it. The district, it's not happening. And, you know, frankly, these reports could be an impediment on that. You know, that who wants to do business with a man who conducts himself this way? They don't want to touch him. And either Dan Snyder builds his own new stadium on the ground that he owns in Landover, or they just stay where they are. And reality is, in the NFL, with the television contracts, the gate is relatively small potatoes. And while it's an embarrassment to see all those empty seats there, or when you got a game like the Cowboys and they're filled, you know, mostly by Cowboy fans, it's not financially devastating. It's just, you know, not as much money as they could be making, but with the amount of money that's flowing in from the television contracts, there really isn't great reason for concern. You know, Art Modell left Cleveland because he couldn't get a new stadium built there. I don't know if Art Modell leaves Cleveland now. I think maybe he stays, and he's the one that really got the ball rolling on the television contracts. He sits fat and happy with all the cash that's gushing in before he ever sells a ticket or a parking space or a box of popcorn. Yeah, it's just the reality of the economics of the game. I talked about this the other day, watching Micah Parsons tear apart the Washington team on Sunday reminded me of Lawrence Taylor. And when Lawrence Taylor came in the league as a rookie in 1981 and was so disruptive that Joe Gibbs invented the H-back position, which was manned for many years by my friend Doc Walker, who was a pass-catching tight end who was made into an extra blocker. He was the one who was helping out Joe Jacoby with LT coming around the end on the blind side of the quarterback. And so that was he was a game changer. LT, you know, the great players are the ones that changed the game. Like, for example, when Lou Alcindor was at UCLA, he was so good they outlawed the dunk for a while. When Wilt Chamberlain came in the league, they widened the lane. You know, things like that happen for great players, and they changed things. They didn't change the NFL rules, but they changed the way the game was played, in that you had to account for him with an extra guy all the time. So yesterday on the Dan Patrick Show, he had two very interesting guests on. One of them, Bruce Arians, who is the coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and the other, Chris Collinsworth, who has been doing the analysis for Sunday Night Football for years. Arians coached against LT. Collinsworth played against LT. This was Arians on the comparison between LT and Micah Parsons.
Well, I don't think so yet. I mean, he's started to have a heck of a career. When you start talking about the best player to ever play defense in this league, slow down just a little bit.
What when I say Lawrence Taylor, what comes to mind?
Fear. Fear. Who the hell? Who's double teaming him?
Well, wasn't it Joe Gibbs who came up with the concept of, I'm going to have Joe Jacoby, but then I'm going to have my tight end just chip Lawrence Taylor. So, or two tight ends there.
Yeah, you had to double team him. I mean, the only other person I saw even like him was Derek Thomas, and just unbelievable people off the edge that could just wreck games.
And you would put LT as the best defensive player of all time.
Yeah, and I'd have Derek Thomas right behind him.
Now, I talked to Joe about this, Joe Jacoby, and he said the thing about LT is he never took a playoff, especially against Washington. Washington was the team he wanted to beat more than any other because he grew up a fan of the team in Blacksburg, Virginia. That was his growing up team, and he wanted to beat them. And many times he was responsible for doing it. He had one of the most famous plays in franchise history when he broke Joe Theismann's leg in that Monday night game. But he was just awesome, just an awesome defensive player. And I talked about this with Max Kellerman yesterday. I saw him on a Sunday night game against the Saints in New Orleans playing with a separated shoulder. He dominated the game with one arm. That's how good Lawrence Taylor was. Now to Chris Collinsworth, who spent some time playing against LT. Collinsworth, a receiver with the Cincinnati Bengals in the 80s. Their careers almost matched up exactly. Collinsworth came in, I think, the same year as LT. And here's what he told Dan Patrick about the comparison.
Probably not. LT was, he was a hammer. He was a big, strong guy that changed everything in protection. It used to be that they always sent the backs out to get the outside linebacker, and LT changed that. So we started putting Anthony Munoz on, like, forget that. We're not doing this traditional stuff, and put him out there. Micah Parsons, I would say, is faster and more athletic, and he doesn't even really play pass rusher as much. Like, if LT dropped into coverage, you were like, thank God, good. I'll take my chances with him back there. Where Micah Parsons really does do a lot in coverage. You know, he was 35 yards down the field in that game the other day, almost had one picked off. So I think they're different guys, but I think is the potential there to have the kind of career that he had? He's pretty flashy.
Yeah, I have not seen an interview with Micah Parsons. I did a number of interviews with Lawrence Taylor. I was around him a lot. I covered the Giants for a couple of years when I was working at WFAN. And the thing about LT was he was completely reckless on and off the field. And he had issues with drugs. He would stay out all night. But he didn't care. I mean, he was just a complete... The fact that he's still alive today probably surprises him. But he was just a completely reckless person. And that may have been an asset to him. Whether that's the case with Parsons or he's just a great athlete. But that mean streak that you have to be a great football player. Oh, LT had that. Oh, yeah. LT. And when LT went hunting, that was it. So it's way early. But we have not had a rookie who was NFL Defensive Player of the Year since Lawrence Taylor. And the way things are going right now, it looks like Micah Parsons is going to win it. You know, he's still got four games to go and anything can happen, but I would not be surprised if that's the case. And from what I saw Sunday against Washington, man, he's going to be something to deal with for a while. One other thing from the Collinsworth conversation I wanted to play for you because I found this interesting. You know, the teams, of the broadcast teams, before they do a game, have meetings with the coach and selected players just to get some inside information. One of the great stories about that, when Steve Spurrier was coaching Washington, they were playing a game in Dallas. And the meetings that were set up for a Saturday. I think a lot of times now they do them on Fridays. But this was a Saturday meeting where Spurrier was supposed to meet with, I think it was Buck and Aikman. And Spurrier was watching the Gators on TV. And so they call his hotel room and they go, Coach, you're supposed to be in a meeting right now with Buck and Aikman to give him a little insight on the game. Okay. So he goes down to the meeting, and according to what I heard, whereas most times players give a lot of off-the-record stuff to the announcers that they can kind of work in, can use, you know, give them more than just you would have in a news conference, Spurrier shows up and gives them a lot of coach speak. And then can't wait to get out of there because wants to get back to watching the Gators. So the next day, and this was the Bill Parcells Cowboys, and they crushed them. They must have sacked the quarterback 12 times. I mean, it was a complete blowout. And they were just killing Spurrier. And I thought, yeah, it's a little over the top. The team played bad, but do you kill Spurrier? Well, what turned out is they were just pissed off that Spurrier had kind of blown them off to watch the Gators, and they weren't going to give them any breaks doing the game. That isn't the case in any of these stories that you can hear from Collinsworth, but he gives you some insight here as to what happens in these meetings between broadcasters, coach, quarterback, and other players.
When you go into these production meetings and you request certain people to talk to, I don't know if there are people who say, no, I'm not going to talk to you, but
all the time.
Oh, they do?
Of course. Yeah.
Like for instance, who would say, no, I don't want to sit down and talk?
Just in general. I mean, some of these guys, they get asked every single week. And, okay, you know, it's Friday after practice and they want to get out of there. And if they're second in line or they got something to do. Yeah, we got the only ones who really sort of have to do it, I feel like, are the coach and quarterback. They don't opt out, but sometimes they drive home, like Tom Brady will talk to us in the car on the way home. You know, he sets up his phone and it does, you know, it's everybody's, it's tech now, it's Zoom. It's just exactly what we're doing here.
But what are you allowed to ask? Like, how much can you get from Brady?
It depends on what kind of mood he's in. You know, sometimes he's literally fantastic. Sometimes, you know, he gets mad at us occasionally and then he's a little less fantastic, but he's a deep, thoughtful, considerate guy. You know, the same guys that you would think of as being smart are the same ones that are the good interviews, you know, whether you go Tom Brady, Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, Peyton Manning, Drew Brees, you know, you go right down the list, the guys that have been around, and they know what they can tell you and what they don't tell you. But a lot of times it comes down to, do they think that you know? So if you ask the right question and you prove to them that you've done your homework and that you've studied something specific, you'll see them kind of light up a little bit, like, oh, okay. okay, you got that, huh? All right. We were talking about that the other day. And a lot of times they'll expound upon that. And that's when it gets really cool. With Bill Belichick one time, I asked him something about some remote defensive end. And he goes, whatever. And I said, well, I go, he plays inside and outside, right? He goes, no, you know, Bill, no, he just plays outside. And so I go, okay. And so he goes on with the interview and goes three or four questions later. And he looked over at me and he went, he did play one snap. And I go, yeah. I said, but, you know, I wasn't going to force my hand here. And he goes, yeah, yeah. And he goes, what do you want to know? And then he let me start asking some questions. And he answered legitimately because he knew that I had done enough detail work that he would now respond to some questions. And it's interesting at the give and take, because you do see they are unafraid to roll their eyes at you if they are unimpressed with the question. And we've had people walk out of the room. I mean, you know, it's that different stuff.
Isn't that interesting that what goes on there in those conversations? Like Bill Belichick wants to find out, you know, how smart you are. Oh, okay, you know what's going on. I'll tell you stuff. If he thinks you're a dope, ain't going to talk to you. I've talked to Tony about this. He was doing Monday Night Football, as you know, for 3 years, and he didn't have to go to these meetings. His role was a little bit different, but he talked about how the various coaches were, and he also said, because this was right after Brett Favre had left the Packers, and it was Aaron Rodgers' team now. Favre was either in, I think he was in New York, or no, at that point, I guess he was in Minnesota, and he was lighting it up. And Tony said they went to the meetings and Mike Tirico was afraid to ask Aaron Rodgers about how Favre was doing. And so Tony asked it and he said Rodgers got pissed about that, you know, like, but he was. I mean, and Favre in his first two games against the Packers beat him in Lambeau Field. So, yeah, it's funny about that stuff. I'm going to read you here what sounds like a depth chart for the Washington defense. Tackle Jonathan Allen, tackle Matt Ioannidis, tackle Tim Settle, end Montez Sweat, end James Smith Williams, end Casey Tuhill, end William Bradley King, linebacker Kaliki Hudson, linebacker David Mayo, cornerback Kendall Fuller. That's not a depth chart. Those are all the players who are on the COVID list. It's up to 11, also including tight end Tamarack Hemingway from the practice squad, who they probably were going to need because of the depth issue that they've got there. This is a mess. Now, from the way this looks, it's possible that all but Sweat will be back on the practice field, if not today, by tomorrow. These are reportedly vaccinated players outside of Sweat, and Sweat had to go into this COVID protocol for 10 days because he's not vaccinated. The others, as long as they have back-to-back negative tests 24 hours apart, they're good to practice. So this outlook could change by the weekend, but we're getting into a period of time as the league has now had 37 new positive tests since Monday that is showing you that, you know, we're far from out of this. We're not that far from where we were last year. The league has said, and they said at the beginning of the season, that they're not going to postpone games and that there could be forfeits. I don't think it'll reach the level where Washington will have to forfeit Sunday at Philadelphia, but it's a very serious situation. I mean, who are you going to play? They'll find bodies. They'll put bodies out there. There are guys, you know, looking to get in the league, and they'll sign them to game contracts, and they'll get out there and have enough bodies on the field. But, man, I mean, this is Allen, Ioannidis, Settle, Sweat. I mean, these are starters, you know. Settle's the rotational guy, but – and then James with Smith-Williams and Casey Tuohill, they were declared on the COVID list 24 hours before the game last Sunday. And they're like third and fourth string guys. Never mind Chase Young, who's out for the year with a knee injury. This is a mess. This is a real mess. And while you'd like to think that this David and Goliath story can continue and they can continue to post wins, putting together, you know, makeshift lineups and a quarterback who wasn't even supposed to play this year but has played almost the entire year because of the Ryan Fitzpatrick injury in the first half of the first game. Can they keep doing this? At some point, you run out of bodies. And just reading this list with Ioannidis added today just makes you go, man. And Ioannidis, he was hurt last year, but he was on the list, which leads me to believe he's possibly not vaccinated. I don't know this. I'm just speculating. But if he was on the COVID, he was like one of a few. And they did a really good job with it last year before the vaccination. And he was on the list last year. If he's got it again, is it possible he's not vaccinated? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. One other football story. This is from the ESPN Plus documentary series on Tom Brady, Man in the Arena. I don't have ESPN Plus. I haven't seen this yet. But the little bits and pieces about this come trickling out. And in last night's episode, you remember the Super Bowl loss that they had to the Giants, Super Bowl 46. And Gisele Bündchen was famously caught on camera saying, "My husband cannot effing throw the ball and catch the ball at the same time." Well, you know, that got a lot of play. And the finger pointed to Wes Welker, who had dropped the pass late in the game. Everybody thought she was, you know, outing Wes Welker, like, well, you know, Wes Welker dropped the ball, my husband can't catch it too. Well, there's more, and this is what this series does. It gives you the backstory. And Bündchen is on this. Gisele is on this series, and she explained what happened near the locker room. Said, so now we have to walk to the freaking elevator, and these guys who possibly had a few drinks are, well, like, your husband sucks, and Eli Manning owns your husband. He's old. He's got to retire. Just tell him to go home and cry like a baby. And that's when she dropped her line. So they get back to the hotel, and this is what Brady says. He says, I remember laying in bed because I didn't sleep that night either, and I was just laying in bed, and she said, I just want to let you know I said something. And Brady said, you can't say that. Then Gisele added, well, I thought I was mild with what I said. It's true. How can he do everything? He can't catch and throw the ball at the same time. That's just the fact. But then, you know, she got the idea, or people told her that, you know, you're throwing Wes Welker under the bus here. And she said, quote, it broke my heart. Are you kidding me? That's like the hardest working guy I know on the team. Welker didn't take it personally, saying, I know where her heart is. I know who she is. I almost agreed with her at the time. I was more mad at myself. So they have, what do they have, five more episodes to go? I think it's a 10-part series. This was episode number 5. And I think what will happen, you know, if I don't want to shell out the money for ESPN+, Plus, I pay so much money for all these cable channels. I got to pay for another one. What they did with the Peyton Manning series is they later ran it on ESPN2. So I would imagine sometime in the spring or maybe the summer, they'll have all these available on free ESPN with the hook of, hey, look at the more programming we're going to have for you on ESPN+. Plus. So I'll probably see them at some point. Coming up, I shake my fist at the clouds once again over what I see in the newspaper today. I'll get to that as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock today, I'm sure, with more on the Washington Post investigation into these allegations that Dan Snyder impeded in the investigation by Beth Wilkinson and her team into the culture of the Washington football team. I've had a lot to say about that today. I want to say something about this, and maybe on your radar, doesn't mean a damn thing, but you know, I still read the paper. I still read the actual newspaper. And when I was in high school, I remember this was a huge deal. And when my son was playing sports in high school, it was a huge deal. He was not on the level of being an All-Met or an All-County or anything like that. But it would be interesting for me to look at the players, some of whom he had competed against, and see how they ranked. And there was a special section put out by the Washington Post, and there'd be big pictures, and you'd see the All-Met basketball team. And today in the Post, they cover it, the Fall All-Met 2021, and there's a picture of some of the athletes of the year in this little four-page section, and they list the players who are All-County or All-Metropolitan, but it's not the same. And on top of that, we don't have local newspapers anymore. We used to have the Gazette and the Sentinel and things like that where they could celebrate this. And this was, you know, a big deal that kids would hang on to these things and they would have them framed and something that you'd have for the rest of your life. Some of them would go on and play college and even pro. But the majority of them, that was the highlight of their athletic career. And it's just a little four-page little thing with fine print of who's, you know, the top players and all that. And I just think it's a shame. I think something's been lost there. You know, everything is done digitally now. I understand that, and people don't read the newspaper and blah, blah, blah. But just to see that makes me sad, because I remember the anticipation. Wow, there's the All-Met section. And you hadn't seen a lot of these guys play, the high school stars, because the games weren't on television. And unless you went to, like, the DeMatha or the Mackin games or something like that, you didn't see them. But you learned about them in these sections. And what you have now is just a shell of what it was. Plus, there's no other local newspaper coverage of this, that nobody else is doing this. I think there's something online called The Patch where they do local stories. But just, you know, picking up that special section, full pages of information on players and pictures, and they would do the All-County teams. Sometimes you'd find a teammate in there. Not anymore. It's all kind of gone by the wayside on that. A couple of academic things. You know the story of J.R. Smith, the former NBA player, won a championship with LeBron, went to the parade without a shirt on, and he enrolled at North Carolina A&T. He never went to college. He was one of the last of the ones who could go directly from high school to the pros. And he had he gone to college, he would have gone to North Carolina. But he finished his NBA career, and he decided he would go to college and walk on to the golf team at North Carolina A&T, which he did. Now, he wasn't that great of a golfer, but the fact that he was a celebrity and an NBA player and playing a sport for the fun of it and for the joy and all that, I don't think he's got designs on going on the PGA Tour, but you never know. But here's the thing. He got a 4.0, great average. Mazel tov to that. Great job. First semester, North Carolina A&T. 4.0. Then he talked about it, and this is where I have an issue. He said, "I can't even describe the feeling. I ain't gonna even lie to you. I ain't gonna lie. A lot of hard work went into this S, you know. Monday through Friday, 8 to 11, sometimes longer, straight schoolwork. When you're not used to going to school and doing all that S, man, freshman year, you don't think you can do it. You always hear about your disabilities. If I'm North Carolina A&T, yeah, I want to celebrate the fact that J.R. Smith got a 4.0, but do I really want that statement to represent a 4.0 student? You know, I mean, shouldn't it sound like he really is? I mean, he is legitimately a 4.0 student. It's just that, you know, the slang and the cuss words ain't, you know, to me. You know, and you might say, shut up, old man. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. That's the way he talks. And he earned that 4.0, and I'm sure he did. And, you know, the fact that he put in the work to do it, he should be congratulated for it. But it's just the kind of statement where you go, yeah, I don't know. That's not quite the sound I want coming from my 4.0 student. And then this from the New York Post. You know, you hear, well, he's not a brain surgeon. He's not a rocket scientist. Well, they've done a study, nearly 400 scientific and medical professionals, and revealed that stereotyped smarty pants, brain surgeons and rocket scientists, possess no upper hand when it comes to the skills needed to succeed in logical, mathematical professions. It's not that they are better at everything, but they are better at certain things that make them good at what they do, says the author of the study, which, you know, makes sense. I mean, there are some people who are really good at something and are just horrifically bad at others. In fact, Tony talks about this all the time. I mean, he says the most frightening words in the English language are some assembly required. Like, he's afraid to do anything mechanical. And he would pay a lot of extra money to have his kids' bicycles put together. You know, he couldn't do that. And so, but he's obviously incredibly bright and incredibly successful in writing and speaking and all that. And he's an English major, which he talks about all the time. So there is that. And so these rocket scientists have the ability to focus on one particular area. Neuroscientists scored higher in language-based problem-solving, while aerospace engineers were better at spatial reasoning, but their overall averages were on par with the general public. So there you go. So you may be as smart as a rocket scientist, or you may be as smart as a doctor or an engineer. It's just that they have one specific thing that they're really good at, and they can do that. And you know, there are certain people that have just that one small thing that they're better at than everybody else. I guess everybody is special in something, and the people that succeed in this are people who are very, very good at this one specific skill that it takes to be a rocket scientist or a neurosurgeon. It was a pretty extensive study. They had 329 rocket scientists, 72 neurosurgeons. They took a bunch of tests at the British Intelligence Agency. And age, sex, and years worked in their respective fields were also taken into account. So there you go. You could say, he's not a rocket scientist. No, he's not, but maybe he's as smart as one. Maybe you're as smart as one. You don't know. Anyway, that wraps up a very interesting day. I probably will have follow-up on this big report in the Washington Post. It's what everybody's buzzing about today and whether or not Dan Snyder's going to be able to keep the team. Again, my takeaway is this is not going to affect that. He'll be the owner of the team by this time next year, but it's just another embarrassing incident in a string of them with this football team. Thanks to Lauren Durnham for running the show. Thanks to all of you who listen. Tony's coming up next. See you tomorrow morning, 10 a.m.
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts, and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the road to a podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching The Stacking Benjamins podcast, wherever you listen.